distressed.
And
welcome
you all to our hearing room. We're scheduled to have an update on the Education Leadership Team report. I'm going to ask Kate to wait a few minutes, and we're going to change the order of the program just a bit and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 221. Representative Hobson. Appreciate that you have a few minutes to spend with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's definitely my pleasure to be here, and I certainly appreciate you rearranging things since I have another committee meeting. And I really want to address Senate Bill 221, and I'm not sure if it's going to make it through the process or not. We're never sure about that. But I think it's so worth taking this opportunity to look at what is a real serious issue in the funding that occurs at different school districts. And I've had passed out to you just the statewide summary of salaries. And the point in this is to show you the difference just when we start out on the often trite level playing field that we have here of a new teacher starting out in a small school district. And I think we all know the small school districts are the rural districts, and quite honestly, quite often they're the ones that are on different poverty scales. Start out with a salary of $23,900. You go to the larger districts, and they start out for the same qualifications at $28,000. So we're actually starting with around a $4,000 difference in the wages that are paid to teachers. You compound that by some of the very specialized areas, and I actually had a bill drafted that included technology, foreign language, math, science, and special ed. Those areas, it's even more difficult to find qualified teachers. And I could even do a caveat there. It's difficult to find any teachers. And then when you start trying to make sure that they have the skills and the qualities that you want, it becomes even more difficult. I, of course, have some concerns in the money coming from the Department of Education and the funding, in that in with all of these, we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, and I haven't found any places that I think really deserve to be robbed. On the other hand, signing bonuses, as we all know, are used throughout the country in various areas, particularly the athletic areas, and I think that Senator Deckard certainly wasn't implying that we do anything quite that extreme. But if you take in that first column some new teacher who makes $3,000 or $4,000 less than a teacher in a larger district that probably isn't as poverty stricken, and you extend that over their lifetime, we are talking big bucks. That compounds, of course, as they stay there longer and they in effect, and I know this is twisting things to support my point, but in a way it's absolutely true. They lose that $3,000 for their whole career if they stay there. And another factor that we have in the small rural districts is quite often young people just out of college would rather go downtown than out on the farm. Now, it may be, in my opinion, they'd be better off out on the farm in Tillamook or someplace, but for a lot of young people, getting away from those areas is what they want to do. So I think this whole idea of signing bonuses, $1,000, it's not enough to make a huge difference, as you can see, when you're talking a basic inequity of $3,000 or $4,000, but it certainly is a step in the right direction, and it also makes a statement that we are concerned about getting qualified, good teachers in these small rural poverty areas. So I'd really encourage you to look at this and to consider it in the big picture of things. And if this isn't the answer, I sure would encourage us to come up with an answer. And until I have a better one, I think this is a good suggestion. As I said before, I had a bill drafted very similar to this although I didn't take it out of the Department of Education, but that's not a half-bad idea. That was very nice of me. So anyway, I would certainly be eager and willing to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, Representative Hobson. I'm wondering, in your reading of Senate Bill 221, are you understanding its application to be to rural school districts only, or how are you? I guess I need some clarity on how you see that definition of rural or economically depressed area. Are you reading that just to mean rural?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley. No, I guess my analogy would have been to look at most of the economic indicators around the state, and those usually end up there in the smaller rural districts. But it wouldn't necessarily have to be limited to that.
I appreciate your response, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Because as we have looked at the definition of distressed community and how we determine where we're going to allocate economic and community development resources, we've come up with the definition of distressed community that encompasses rural and urban communities and populations. And that definition comes out of some work that the good Senator Ferrioli and I did back in 1997. I think it was Senate Bill 935, which actually codified a definition of distressed community. So as I was reading this bill last night, I got a little concerned about whether the definition of economically depressed might be a little too narrow. And I really should be addressing this to Senator Deckard as well as you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard,
just for information purposes, when I was drafting this bill, we borrowed heavily from the work that Senator Ferrioli and Senator Gordley used, and purposely used that work to put, I believe it's line six, the enterprise zone, which was creatively developed based on the work that my two colleagues to the right on this committee did in the previous sessions. And so Senator Gordley is absolutely correct that this would apply not only to, because I think the problem not only exists in rural communities, but it also applies in economically depressed areas of Oregon, whether that be a city inside an urban growth boundary or in a rural district. So I think that is an important point.
May I follow up with one additional
yes, Senator Gordley.
Question and clarification then? Am I to understand also then that this would include federally designated enterprise zones? There's not a direct reference to recognized zones. You do recognize federally recognized Oregon Indian Reservation, etc. Are we to imply or?
I do have a dash to amendment. I mean, part of, we're allowing Representative Hobson, but part of my suggestion was going to be that we need to move this to Ways and Means. I do have a dash to that that we could adopt. One of the things that I was going to ask the committee to do on this bill is to move it to Ways and Means because it has a price tag attached to it. But the dash to, and I will pass this over to Senator Gordley, does clarify that it's economic and community development zones, so that would really hit, which I think is the areas that we're hoping to address. As Representative Hobson talked about the rural areas, I think you could make the same case in our large metropolitan school districts that there is an issue to address. And so I'd be more than happy to adopt this issue if the committee chooses to, and then send it to Ways and Means to really narrowly define who we're trying to get at here.
Further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been given a table here. I don't know if that was yours or that was issued with your knowledge. where it's got Oregon at the top, is that the average?
Thank you, Mr.
Oregon.
Senator Fisher, this is from the COSA OSBA booklet that they put out, and what this does, this is an initial summary, then it goes through with every school district in the state and gives their starting salary and their salary schedule. This is a composite of those at the beginning of the book and indicates that in school districts with an average daily membership of 1 to 99, the starting salary for the teachers is $23,900. Then it moves up districts with 100 to 499.
The top line is what I was referring to.
I'm sorry.
The total average for Oregon?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I understood.
Sorry, I should have explained it better when I...
No. That's... just always that we're not always familiar with exactly the way things are done. Mr. Chair, I had a further question.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does this compare in a weighted way with other VA starting salaries in the state? For instance, if it was weighted so that the extra vacation time and stuff like that was off in comparison to somebody that was working full-time just as a with a BA degree.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, you took half my answer right there. I was going to plead. I really don't have that information, but I do know it's available because I've participated in a number of bargaining sessions where that important issue has come up, because you can't compare the apple and orange of a beginning pharmacist with a beginning teacher when one works 9 months and one works 12. But I do know that information is available. I'm sorry, but I'm not the right person to answer that.
Well, the reason I was saying that, I just had a daughter that entered the work field here rather recently with a double VA, and know what her beginning salary was. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I might guess it was more than that.
No, you
may
guess wrong.
Oh, then I definitely would. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Representative Thompson.
And committee, if I could add one more thing. There are a number of districts around the state that already do offer signing bonuses and various other ways to give additional compensation to teachers, particularly in the specialist areas. The problem with that, and one of the issues that I think Senator Deckard's bill addresses, is if you already have the money, it's easier to do that. If you're a poor district that doesn't have the money, then you're not going to be able to come up with the extra money to give yourself as a signing bonus. So it's kind of a double bind there, and there is some need for some outside help with the districts that are poor.
Any further questions? Thank you, Representative Hobson.
Thank you very much.
And we'll have Paul Evans.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for allowing me to be here today and share with you some thoughts about Senate Bill 221.
Put your name on the record, please.
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I live at 744 East Main Street in the metropolis of Monmouth, Oregon, 97361. I came here, in fact, I asked Senator Deckard when this bill was coming up to come here to speak in favor of this bill, or more specifically, in favor of the general purpose of the bill. Although Senate Bill 221 may, in fact, be a largely symbolic act, or a small-scale solution, if you will, it is a significant step in the right direction. Recognizing the need for an investment in teachers in targeted areas makes sense. As mayor of a small town, which is Monmouth, I must confess that I'm uncertain whether this measure will directly impact our school district 13J or not once the criteria is established. But I would be here either way because it's the right thing to do. In high school, when I was taught government, I was taught that government is of the people, by the people, and for the people. And I believe this. And if it is true, then we must demand an education system that provides for all the people. Translated, we must provide an education and training system for all the people's children. I live in a semi-rural area. My family comes from a very rural area. I know the challenges of finding talent for work in rural Oregon. It is important to recognize that whether you are from Portland or Prairie City, Bend, or Beaverton. We have a shared interest in making sure Oregonians are prepared for tomorrow. This suggests that students would not suffer, or should not suffer, because of disparities in relative wealth among our school districts. And let's be honest, $1,000 bonuses by themselves will not be enough to solve the enduring problems, but it is a start. We have a lot of work to do, and I'm here today in a very simple, hopefully straightforward way, asking for help, especially on behalf of rural Oregon. I know you have a lot on your plate, and your time here is filled with a host of decisions, but I believe, again, that symbolically this is one of your more important ones. On behalf of the students and parents that couldn't be here today, those of 13J and the Monmouth and Independence area, I'm asking you to pass this measure and renew the real promise of Oregon. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to gavel out of hearing on this and come back to it after we've had our presentation on the Education Leadership Team report. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a possibility we could get some figures on what starting salaries are for BA degrees across the board in Oregon?
I don't know where to go for that, but we can certainly.
Mr. Chair, is the question I have, and I'll get to this later if we come back to 221 this afternoon. I have a few districts, the starting salary for B. Your question, Senator Fisher, is for BAs?
Not for teachers.
Oh, not for teachers.
Or the overall plane of people with the same degree.
I do not have those figures.
We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 221. And we invite Kate Dixon up.
BS is a lot more difficult than BA.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm pretty busy right now.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for the opportunity to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon to discuss Project Success. For the record, I'm Kate Dixon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And when I joined the Department of Education, this was my first task. So it's a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to report to you today regarding this project. One point, though, regarding the last conversation, can I make that? I think you can get information from the Employment Department. So,
thank you.
Okay. Project Success for Oregon's Educational Future, Framework for Leadership, Action, and Accountability, is a result of the bill that was passed in the last session, House Bill 3633, and many of you probably remember that as you had the opportunity to work with it and vote on it. Inside the front cover, I'll just remind you about the Executive Committee and begin to tell you just a little bit about the work that we did in Project Success. First of all, the Executive Committee for Project Success was a bipartisan leadership team, including the governor, the president of the Senate at that time, Brady Adams, the Speaker of the House, Lynn Snodgrass, Superintendent Stan Bunn, who chaired the committee, Jack Roberts as Commissioner of Bureau of Labor, and Joe Cox, the Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and Cam Pruse-Brawley, Commissioner, Community College and Workforce Development. Then there were some additional representatives appointed to this committee, including the Superintendent of Public Schools in Portland, and representatives from higher ed, business, early childhood, and also the legislature. And I would like to note that Miguel Salinas, as a parent and advocate representative from Westland, Oregon, who is here today, was also part of our committee work. We began with the challenge of how do we develop the leadership proposal for education in the state of Oregon. We were charged by the bill to begin to set the leadership direction for Oregon education. And the bill was called Project Success for Oregon's Educational Future. And we began by working as a full committee and had some very interesting meetings. Our first meetings really began to look at what are some of the critical issues facing Oregon education. And we really started from kind of a critical issues look. And we used a modified strategic planning effort in our work, and we began to say if these are some of our critical issues, and it really began to be some of the obvious critical issues that you can imagine, how do we assure that every student in Oregon is educated to a high level? How do we assure that we create high-performing schools and begin to move all of our schools into that range? What do we do about our minority students that are disengaged in our schools? How do we assure that every student learns to read? Those were the beginning to be the growing list of critical issues that we looked at. And so then we began to say, what are our core values about education in Oregon? And this group worked for an entire day sorting through what they believed were core values and strategic priorities. Some of the core values that began to mean a lot to this leadership team was the core value about the commitment to relentlessly pursue each student's success. And that came from the notion that every student is a valuable person to be considered to be educated in the state of Oregon, and that we need to assure that we can foster a learning environment of hope, pride, trust, creativity, and challenge for those students, that we can ensure quality, opportunity, and support for learning, develop each student's capacity for lifelong learning, and realize the individual potential for high performance and achieving dreams. From those core values, we began to develop from the House Bill agenda, what would we identify as strategic priorities? And it was interesting because as we worked through what we believed were the critical issues, what were the core values, we began to flow out of that what we believed were our strategic priorities. And on page 5, we have those listed, and we came up with 4. And we disciplined ourselves from a list of 16. So it could have been a list of 16, but we said, no, let's try to focus our leadership agenda here. And so out of our work, we began to identify that reading is a gateway to learning, and that we have to have a commitment that all children learn to read and learn to read well, pre-K through 16. That we need to continue to maintain and enhance teaching and administration quality. That we need to assure that we have teachers that are well qualified and support their continuing development through professional development. Third, that we must create connections for student success. And this has multiple aspects to it. Number one is that we need to find ways that our students can have a pre-K through 16 seamless educational experience, that we can no longer afford to have a society where we lose kids between the cracks. So how do we assure in our educational system that it is a successful system for students pre-K through higher ed? We also realized that students needed to have the opportunities to be connected to businesses and other opportunities for education. And so the partnerships and those connections as well were part of our conversation. And fourth, the obvious one, but also one that needs to be very explicit, is our accountability for results. That we need to be sure that we develop an accountability system that is honest, that is fair, that is educationally sound, and that motivates and supports improved student achievement and student success. And that was very important to the leadership group. We formed 2 working committees over the summer, and we did an extensive amount of work on reading as a gateway to learning, and the second one, maintaining and enhancing teaching and administration quality. Connections for student success is one that there are a number of programs already in the process of being developed, and what we're hoping to do is to provide some coordination between some of those programs so that it may not be a working committee, but it may be a committee to try to integrate a number of the aspects that are currently already involved. And then accountability for results is a piece that we're working on through the Department of Education, and basically trying to look at what are all of our accountability systems that we have in place, all the way from the report card that currently exists to consolidated school district plans. And there are a number of places that we have an accountability measure, but we don't have it in a complete system. So we're looking at ways to do that. So starting on page 6, we look more in a more detailed way around some recommendations that we have as reading as a gateway to learning. And a couple of things that happened in this work group that worked was, to try to keep in perspective what we thought we could influence, and also not to create so many goals that we couldn't be successful. And several things began to emerge. One is we needed to establish reading goals. And our reading goals are the ones that have been connected to the quality education model, which really embraces the notion that we need to assure that every child, grades 3 through grade 5, can read to grade level. But we also expanded it to say that students beyond grade 5 need to continue to have the support in reading so that they can read at their grade level. And oftentimes, when students reach middle school or high school, the textbooks are so challenging that they have a very difficult time staying engaged in their work because they can't read the textbooks. We also talked about the concept of establishing a reading education foundation. This really came from some work that we did with connected with some people in Kennewick, Washington. They've created a statewide reading foundation, not so much to give out resources, which sometimes we think about as a way to for foundation work, but really being a clearinghouse for information, for best practices, to provide parents and community members with resources and so forth. And we'd like to continue to have some conversations in the future about how this might get established at a state level. We also believe that teachers need to continue to be prepared and to work towards their ability to teach reading to a high level. And again, we focused on pre-K through grade 5 teachers, assuring that the teachers are well prepared out of their teacher preparation programs to teach reading, and that there's opportunities for effective professional development to continue for teachers. And one of the things that we talked a lot about was that every teacher is a reading teacher. And how do we assure that teachers have the support in order to be able to be successful in that? Another major area of focus for us for reading and to support continuing to help teachers and students be successful is to assure that we can increase minority staff representation in our schools. That oftentimes, when children with English as a second language come to our school, there's no one in the school that can speak their language or speak it effectively so that they can help students make that transition from learning from their own language to learning to read in English. And one of the ideas that we have talked a little bit about is to reactivate the Oregon Teacher Corps, which was a part of how some people moved into the teaching profession early to expand minority mentorships. And this is a scholarship program that used to be in place and still on the books, but we haven't used it for a number of years. And then the marketing and communication strategies that reading is a very important skill for all of our students and that it is of high value. The other working group that we spent time with was the working group on maintaining and enhancing teaching and administration quality. This was a very high priority for the leadership team as well. And we really looked at it in several areas. In the area of recruitment, how do we recruit some of our talented young people that are in high school to encourage them to become teachers? And one of the things that you've just heard is the issue around we have more and more of a teacher shortage, and it shows up first in our rural areas or our areas where that our enterprise areas and that sort of thing. And what we really need to do is examine aggressively, I believe, how we recruit people into the field of education, encourage people to think about education as a successful career for themselves. And so we'd like to begin encouraging the recruitment of high school students and college students into the field. And many of you probably know students that 4 years ago were seniors in high school, and this year, well, I guess it would probably be five, but this year they are successful teachers, beginning teachers in school districts. I know several young people that they graduated from high school about 5 years ago and now are successful teachers here in Oregon. And so they make that shift very quickly. So how do we support that recruitment? Another area that we wanted to continue to work with and are the preparation and licensure programs, to be sure that there's the kind of connection between what the real life of a teacher is and the preparation programs. And there's a lot of work that's currently going on in Oregon to develop teacher preparation programs that have higher standards. And I would take a minute just to compliment the work of TSPC over the last 5 years or so. They've worked with the teacher preparation programs, and they've really begun to develop some very useful competency programs and proficiency programs for young people in their teacher preparation programs. And then the continuation of teacher and administrator professional development. One of the things that I would just like to remind all of us in relationship to teacher preparation is that students oftentimes will spend 4 years of their college experience majoring in their area of focus, whether it's science or mathematics or English or history, and then they move into a Master's of Arts in Teaching, which gives them a year to really prepare to become a teacher, and then they're in the classroom, and many of them come in with great anticipation, highly motivated, and within 3 or 4 years they start to leave the profession because they don't have the kind of ongoing professional development support. And I would just plead that we find ways to encourage our teachers to continue their professional development and support them in that way. And with that, I think I've already talked about Connections for Student Success. We believe strongly that if students are going to be successful in our schools, we have to create those opportunities for connections and accountability. So that was our work. We came up with 4 strategic priorities that we think can be a framework for much of our work in the educational community around those 4 strategic priorities: ensuring our children can read, professional development for our teachers, systems for connections for student success. Students that are successful in school are usually connected, and accountability, being sure that we are using our resources wisely and for the best benefit for our students. So that was our work as a leadership team. We had a number of very, very dynamic conversations, and I think people are very pleased with the work that we did. And I might say that as diverse as our committee was, we did reach consensus on these strategic priorities, and we were proud of ourselves, if nothing else, for that. So with that, I'll entertain any questions or comments.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon.
Hi.
A couple of questions for you, and I have to admit I'm not as prepared for the discussion today as I would like to be. We tried to get through to your office on yesterday. We forgot that it was President's Day.
My apologies.
Not everybody was doing what we were doing yesterday, which is working. A couple of questions, though. Does the leadership team still exist?
Technically, we exist until July, at the end of this biennium, or June 30th, excuse me. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. We will the bill sunsets as of June 30th, 2001. We intended to complete our work by December of 2000 so that we could make this report to the legislature. So mm-hmm. We theoretically could continue to meet, but at this point, we have reached, you know, what we wanted to accomplish within the our recommendations.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Where does the responsibility lie then for following up on the recommendations in this document? Is it the Department of Education? Where's the point person?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, at this point, the responsibility rests with all of us in some regard. One of the reasons we included this checklist in this brochure was to suggest that there are a number of audiences that have a role in this work. At this point in time, our charge was to provide recommendations based on House Bill 3633. And we also wanted to suggest who could take some responsibility for these recommendations. We have no responsibility for the enforcement of these recommendations. They really come as recommendations.
Or coordination, Mr. Chair? Who is responsible for coordination of the efforts and the recommendations that are detailed in the report?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe that Superintendent Bunn and the Department of Education will take most of the responsibility for the coordination of this work.
You believe they will or they will? And I'm not trying to be hard on you. I'm just trying to find out who's going to coordinate. There was a lot of work here.
Yes.
And this is a nice brochure. And I see the column that's listed responsible for action in these various categories, but if no one has really got oversight and there's no one saying, how are we doing with the checklist, will we ever get the checklist, will we actually get to the tasks? For example, well, let's hone in on the legislative piece. What are the specific legislative proposals in this document, which I'm seeing for the first time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think the best way for me to answer this is that these are recommendations. There are a number of areas that the legislature could choose to take the responsibility for. We, as the department, will follow up with a number of these recommendations. But one of the aspects of the bill itself did not charge any particular agency with responsibility to coordinate or to follow through. What we were asked to do, what Superintendent Bunn was asked to do, was to chair the committee to identify the priorities. And we took that a step further to create some action plans on what we could do with these priorities. But for example, under the legislature, one of the areas would be to begin to see whether or not the legislature wanted to support creating a reading foundation for the state of Oregon. No one has to do that, but that would be the sort of responsible area that the legislature could
Mr. Chair,
take that on.
Senator Gordley.
No one has to do that, but there were two legislators who served on the executive committee, Senator Hartung and Representative Winters.
Yes.
Did they feel strongly enough about that recommendation that they agreed to work on it or identify other legislators who might want to work on it? Again, I'm just trying to lift these things up off the page and make them real, and I need to hear something more than I'm hearing now about ownership of the recommendation.
It's Senator Starr, Chair Starr, Senator Gordley, I believe that what's there for the legislator to pick up responsibility for is it's whether or not someone in the legislature wants to take the lead on it. And at this point, there's some discussion. I know that Representative Winters has had some discussion, but I'm not sure she's actually going to bring something forward at this time.
Okay.
I believe that the responsibility that is with the Department of Ed is to take the ones that we can do something about without legislative action and continue to move them forward. We are taking a great deal of action on reading as a gateway to learning in some other ways. As you know, Superintendent Bunn, it's one of his primary priorities as well. And so we're doing a number of things to move the reading agenda forward. We also feel very strongly in supporting ongoing professional development for teachers. And we're working on that, a policy package to provide a teacher mentor program. So we've had this question before. This is not the first time this question has come up,
sure,
by the way. And it's a little difficult to answer, partially in the way that the bill was written and the fact that it was sunsetted at the end of this biennium. It really was a bill to provide recommendations. But your question is a very good question. So who's going to take the recommendations and do something about it? And at this point, I can tell you that the agency that I work in have responsibility for, we are taking some of these recommendations and moving them forward, but we're not taking them all. And if you'd like to take on some of these recommendations as a committee, I would be happy to work with you.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may respond to that.
Uh-oh.
And thank you.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you so much for your response. I appreciate the position that you're sitting in right now. I think Senator Durfler has given us an opportunity in his desire to create policy boards this session that examine a number of issue areas. Senator Durfler and Senator Brown are working together in establishing these policy boards, and one of them is focused on K-12. I've been asked to serve in a leadership role on that particular policy board, and as of this morning, I was kind of mulling around, do I want to do this, and how do I do it, and, you know, what issues do we take on? And they're all here. There are others, but many of them are here. And so what I'm saying out loud, can't believe I'm saying this out loud, is that, yeah, I'm committed to working on this and want to work on it with you and also the department. But we need what's missing here are timelines. Mm-hmm. There are no timelines. Mm-hmm. And also what's missing are some people who were involved in leadership are now have moved off the scene. And so we need to, and that creates a void, and we need to fill those roles. But we also, as legislators, and particularly those of us who are working on the education committees this session, need to own this work. We need to own it and carry it forward. But the other responsible parties who are listed here also need to own their pieces. And I would ask, does everyone understand that a role has been identified for them? I'm not clear that that information is well known.
Senator Starr, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, thank you for the opportunity to respond to this question. Some folks, particularly the districts and the ESDs, have less information about this than others, and we do have a communication responsibility in relationship to that. We did have the opportunity to present this to the Teacher Standard and Practices Commission about 3 weeks ago. And that's why I said this wasn't the first set of questions I've had about who's responsible. And we've also had some opportunity to present it to the legislature, and we've presented it to the House Student Achievement and Accountability Committee. And one of the reasons that I've asked to present it here today, and also we've presented it to the State Board of mm-hmm. Education. And Senator Gordley, you've really identified exactly sort of where we are in the evolution of this work. We really have four very important strategic priorities. We've identified some key issues that we could take a leadership role in as a state, but we quite frankly sort of ran out of time. December showed up, and the most that we could get accomplished were some beginning action plans, and I would put them in that language. And they do not have strict timelines, obviously, to them. And I know I will speak for Superintendent Bunn. He is very interested in continuing this work. One of the pieces of this work is that it's the first time we've even identified a statewide collaborative leadership agenda for education. It is the first time a bipartisan group came together and said, if we could really focus on educational success for each student, what would we focus on? And we identified four key areas. Now, they may not always be the key areas, but they really have stood sort of the test of this time anyway, that reading is an absolute key priority, that professional development of teachers and administrators is absolutely essential, that our children, if they're going to be successful, have to be connected to their experiences. Mm-hmm. And then we have to be accountable, and I have to hurry, because I saw Jan just say, okay, Mr. Chair. So Senator Gordley, in a very short way, I would be just delighted to work with you with this policy group and to try to put some meat on some of the bones around this effort around the educational leadership team.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher, we're...
Yeah, I know, but I guess I maybe not hitting this from the same angle as my good counterpart from Portland over there, but are kids dumber than they used to be?
Absolutely not.
Are...
Senator Fisher.
They incapable of learning to read as early as we used to learn to read?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, our children over time have been very capable of learning to read and do well in school.
How much of an effort does it take to say that a method that we've been trying to use, that evidently to salve our ego, that we just can't seem to give up, isn't working? We need to go back to some of the ways that we did before, when we had a whale of a lot more success with kids learning to read. I'm talking strictly about a phonics that teaches a kid to take apart a word and put it together, and it gives you the basic going at attacking any word. You know, we say, have this old saying that if all else fails, go back and read the instructions. Can't we do that apparently in education today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I would say that we have a number of important ways to teach children to read, and teachers are working very hard, and they do include phonics. I think we've all agreed for many years that children can learn to read well, and they are. In fact, our reading scores for our students is going up. We're not coming from a place where we're not doing as well. We have about 80% of our students across Oregon reading at grade level in grade 3, where 10 years ago we had about 50% of our students reading at grade level in grade 3. So we are doing better, but we need all of our children reading to grade level, and that's really the issue. The issue is how do we assure that all children can read, but we also have seen a lot of progress in children learning to read over the last 10 years.
We've got a fellow senator out here who wants to testify on a bill, and he's got a time constraint, so if we can hold this, I'd appreciate it. And Kate, I thank you very much. I want to
thank
talk
you.
To you soon about some things we might do further implement what we've just been exposed to today. And thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would consider this the first opportunity for you to see this, and I apologize for just handing it out and sort of zip. But so let's do consider this the first conversation. I would like that a lot.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate
very much.
We're going to change our program again and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 195, I believe. And Senator Barr has brought that bill to us. And Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator for District 15. I bring you Senate Bill 195. which is a bill that would set up the process for school districts that choose to do, for local people of school districts that choose to do so, to split their district into smaller units. Currently, we have a process in place in government for, in state level, for school districts to combine. If the people of an area so choose, they can take two school districts and by a vote of the population of that area, they can combine and become one school district. Unfortunately, I think, in my opinion, the process to do the reverse does not exist. If residents of a local area decide that they would rather have their school area be two separate school districts, there is no way for that to happen currently in Oregon. In 1997, this body passed and the governor signed a bill to allow a specific school district to split into two smaller school districts. It was decided by the people of that local area that they did not like having one big combined school district, and so this body passed a bill, and the governor signed that bill, Governor Kitzhaber, to allow that single school district to split up. And I guess my theory is that if it's good for that school district and if good for the people of that community to split a school district, then why don't we have a process for the entire state to do the same if they so choose? And I think it's important to note this bill does not change the requirement that those school districts would be K-12. This bill would still require it to be a K-12 district in both sides if a school district splits up. And let me give an example, I guess. A local here in Salem, there are five high schools in the Salem-Kaiser School District. I believe it's five. And if for some reason the people of this large school district decided that they could run the schools better, if they were two separate school districts or three separate school districts, I think the process should be there so that they have that option to do that. It's a local issue, and we don't mandate anything. All this bill does is set up that process.
They're trying to get a $1,000 bonus because
I don't know what else to add on the issue. I think it's
this is for teachers.
To me, it just becomes an issue of local control, and I think that's one thing that most everyone in this building always claims to be supporting, that we want to support local control of our schools. This bill would just allow more flexibility and control by local people for an area. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of Senator Barr?
Much less, the ones with 33,000
plus. Pretty straightforward. Put control in the hands of the local voters, and I appreciate very much your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would not try to pretend that this bill is not without controversy. I think there are groups signed up that would like to testify in opposition to the bill, but I guess my response to that would be, if local voters want and think schools would be better managed as smaller districts, why should we prevent that?
Thank you.
Thank you for scheduling the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I must have a tight schedule.
I don't know about
this. All right. Continue with our discussion, John Marshall and Chuck Bennett.
Appreciate you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I come to you this afternoon as a veteran of the great mandatory school district unification wars of 1991. You notice I didn't say decorated veteran. I don't think there were any heroes in that battle. The issue of mandatorily unifying school districts had been around for a long time. There was a significant movement in the late 50s that significantly reduced the number of school districts. But it wasn't until 1991, coincidentally, I believe, in the wake of the passage of Measure 5, that the legislature undertook requiring that within 5 years all school districts be K-12, that is, provide a full K-12 educational program. Prior to then, there were more than 300 school districts, many of which were high schools, independent high school districts with their component elementary districts, and a variety of other kinds of school districts termed unified elementary districts that taxed their patrons for a K-12 program but did not operate a high school. So they were required to levy those taxes on their patrons and use those dollars to tuition their students into other high schools. The reasons for the push towards mandatory school district unification in 1991, and by the way, we did not support that move. We were all alone. The governor supported it. The superintendent of public instruction supported it. The Oregon Education Association supported it. The Confederation of Oregon School Administrators supported it. I'd name anybody else, and I think they were all in line in support of that measure. The Speaker of the House took it on as a cause. The bill passed the Senate with little debate, in fact, almost unanimously, and then went over to the House, where I think it was assumed, well, don't worry, the House will take care of it. It ultimately was tabled in the House Education Committee, finally came out of committee. There was an ugly fight on the floor of the House. It passed and was signed into law by the governor. In the five-year period following the passage of that bill, and by the way, it said within 5 years all school districts should be K-12 units, there was a great deal of effort put into assisting school districts and moving forward to meet that mandate. Prior to 1991, there were 307 school districts. In 1991, there are now 198, so the number of school districts was reduced by a third. I think it's safe to say that there are still wounds in many communities that were forced to unify from that mandate. Those wounds are now beginning to heal. I believe that Senate Bill 195 takes us in the wrong direction and, frankly, will begin to open up some of those wounds. This issue of allowing a school district to create smaller school districts is not a simple one. If there is an area, as Senator Byers suggests, of a large high school with a high school and its very convenient middle school or elementary school feeder schools, then one can envision the possibility of sort of neatly moving that off to create a school district on its own. What the bill, I don't believe, envisions are circumstances where an elementary school may decide, well, we can do better on our own, and decide to go off, and then they end up as being a small elementary school district without a high school. So I think if you think about how this bill is set up, it doesn't necessarily create a circumstance for equal treatment of all school districts. It's just going to be those large ones where convenient sized chunks can be taken off. I'd hate to see some of the wounds that I said are healing open up again. There are a number of complexities. For example, if the patrons of a school district have decided to tax themselves through the issuance of a bond measure, just because a portion of that school district leaves does not relieve the patrons of that portion from that debt. They would still be paying debt to pay off the bonds of the larger school district, even though they went off to create their own, and perhaps would have to, at some point, create additional debt in order to expand facilities for the new school district. The issue that Senator Byers spoke of from I believe it was the 97 session, was the Napa school district that wanted to break off from Clatskanie. Clatskanie is a school district up the Columbia River. Clatskanie was one of those traditionally high-resource school districts. They spent a great deal per student. Over the course of the decade of the 90s, when equalization came about, they had to make some significant cuts. Well, the Napa High School is sort of over the hill, more towards Clackamas or Clatsop County than it is Columbia County, where the major portion of the Clatskanie School District is located. The folks in that area felt that they'd be better on their own with their own smaller high school, their own funding circumstance, rather than being a part of this larger school district and forced to bear the brunt of some pretty significant cuts that that school district made. So there was a bill that created specifically for that circumstance to occur. If in your wisdom you decide you want to create the ability of some school districts to split, I think we would prefer that you look at it on a case-by-case basis, rather than Senate Bill 195, which sort of opens up the whole thing and creates its own set of complexities. And again, I'm afraid create a circumstance where it would be conceivable that a portion of a school district, say a high school in a larger district, would feel, well, we're not getting fair treatment from the school board and the school administration over here, so we're going to threaten to break off unless you give us what we want. Creating that kind of a situation I don't think is healthy, and we would encourage you to reject Senate Bill 195. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to respond to any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fisher.
Did the Napa district break off?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, yes, they did. They are now the Napa School District. They have their own high school, their own middle school, and their own elementary school.
Successful.
I believe that as far as they're controlling their own destiny over on the other side of the hill, they're doing quite well. I would submit, however, that they're probably facing a similar circumstance that you hear about with a lot of other small school districts, and that given the funding situation, it's difficult for them to maintain the resources to operate a small high school. And so as you hear about small schools and the difficulty of some districts to maintain a comprehensive program in a small high school, I think they're probably in that boat with a lot of other school districts in the state.
I wasn't here in 91, but I did get to go to war in the next two sessions. Seems to me one of the arguments that we so often heard was that in addition to improvement in program offerings, that there would be evidence of cost savings. Do you feel that that has actually resulted from the mergers that occurred?
Mr. Chairman, to my recollection, the argument of the proponents of mandatory school district unification was never one of cost savings. Obviously, in some smaller school districts, by replacing a superintendent slash principal at an elementary school with just a principal and then a superintendent over the entire school district might have resulted in some cost savings. I think some testimony you saw earlier is generally school administrators are, their salary is based by the size of the school district. So a larger school district, you still have to have somebody in charge of a building, and whether they're called a principal slash superintendent or just a principal, I think their salaries probably went up. So I'm not aware I'm certain there's been no research done that would quantify any kind of cost savings. And the argument, frankly, was never made that we ought to do this to save money. I think it was, and Mr. Bennett might talk about some of the rationale for their support of the bill in 91, but if I recall, it was more a greater coordination of curriculum between elementary schools and high schools and creating more efficient units as measured by the ability to deliver educational services rather than actual reduction in costs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'm not a veteran of the 1991 wars. In fact, we're sort of the peace and prosperity generation of education lobbyists that are hoping we'll continue to follow the route we're taking right now. I did have a chance, though, to visit with some folks who were involved at the time. And in 1991, COSA did support mandatory school district unification. We believe the plan has been successful. It was to create more efficient units for educational service delivery and a more coordinated curriculum between elementary schools and high schools. We believe that's been successful. In addition, it was also to enhance the ability of the legislature to equalize school district funding by creating comparable educational groupings. And we believe that's been the success, and that is the model that we're currently using as we deal with education funding, the quality education model, and all of the rest of the essentially the array of tools that are available to you today. And we hope that you will continue down this road and reject Senate Bill 195, which we think heads in a different direction.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Yes, I can back them up. It certainly didn't cut any costs. All the teachers were swallowed up by the bigger unit, and their salaries went up immensely. Some of these schools are run reasonably by some pretty hard-headed farmers and people that were there. They involved the whole community. These little schools were the centers of the community and provided a whole lot more just an education. We lost that to gain something so-called better, and I'm not at all sure that it was better.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, I would think, just a guess, that we lost probably just economies of scale. We lost some of your folks, which was a savings, I would think.
Just that's certainly true, Senator. That's probably our organization lost as large a number of members as any group would, aside from the school boards, who, as mm-hmm. John described, there were in excess of 300 school districts. Now there's 98.
And do you know, Mr. Chair, how many administrators we lost during that period? Man, there has to be a price tag of savings attached to that somehow.
Senator, that was not a question I asked, but I certainly could find out for you.
It'd be interesting.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. No one else signed up? Anyone else want to testify on the bill? If not, we're going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 195 and open a public hearing, reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 221. We have Senator Decker.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have much to add to what Representative Hobson and the Mayor of Independence had indicated on this bill. Just briefly, the rationale behind it was, I think we face, the evidence is pretty clear that we face a national teaching shortage in this country, and it's most pronounced in Oregon, in areas that somewhat fit our enterprise definition of those areas of our state that are rural in nature or economically depressed. And so my goal in drafting this was to find a somewhat creative solution that the private sector uses to induce educators, and particularly probably new educators, to locate in those areas as an enticement. So my request would be, if it's the will of the chair and the members of this committee, is to adopt the Dash 2, which narrowly defines distressed areas in Oregon, and then, because it does have a price tag, send it to Ways and Means to see what they think of this idea.
Thank you very much. Tricia Bosak. Bosak.
Thank you, Chairman Starr. I'm Tricia Bosak, representing the Oregon Education Association, and I first want to say that we appreciate Senator Deckert's attention to attracting qualified teaching personnel to districts. However, we do have a few concerns about Senate Bill 221 that I wanted to just point out, about 4 points on this. First of all, acknowledging that he was trying to keep a modest proposal, we feel like it may represent more of a short-term fix to something that needs longer-range solutions. We don't really feel like $1,000 would may not attract many people to some of the districts in question here, and also won't work to keep them. So therefore, we feel that it may be a loss of state investment funds in running a program like this, and I'll explain why. For instance, this could represent a new teacher getting the signing bonus would get that their first year of teaching, but likely the way the pay scales are set up, the increment between the first year and the second year wouldn't exceed $1,000, and so they therefore would be faced with a pay cut the second year, and probably wouldn't recoup those monies until their third year of teaching. And we feel like this probably wouldn't be an incentive to stay in the district and feel that part of what districts would want to do in attracting people would also to be keep them and to stabilize their staffing situation. So that is one of the concerns that we have about the bill. Secondly, in some of the research that we've done, teachers leave districts for more reasons than just pay. And one of the things that they do cite is lack of support or mentoring, a word we've used a lot recently, lack of support or mentoring for themselves early in their careers. We feel like that a better use of state funds would be to give districts the opportunity to set up mentoring programs and professional development programs that would help keep teachers and stabilize teaching teacher staffing in various districts. So instead of watching their investments walk out the door after a year or two, that we work to keep that investment and build on that investment by mentoring teachers and assisting them in their careers. A third point I wanted to make is that whether it's the bonus notion or however we try to grapple with attracting and retaining personnel, we feel like that can be accomplished through the bargaining process that exists. It is done now in various districts. I think Representative Hobson touched on this earlier. It takes various forms. For instance, in some districts, they kind of front-end load the salary schedule so that it works to, if they're having problem with getting new teachers, it helps attract new teachers. They also do things like artificial placements on the salary schedule to place those harder-to-get personnel, and make some compensation, too, sometimes for veteran teachers who are already there, so there's not that tension, if you will, created for new people doing somehow better than people who've made a commitment to stay in the district. So we feel like that those are solutions that are best dealt with at the local level so that they can be tailored to what local districts' needs are. Finally, and no small point for us, is with the budget situation the way it is, this does take general fund monies to fund it. There are other programs that are already, their funding is already in question, and we would think that, I guess, mentoring programs and things like that are a little bit on the bubble in the budget situation right now, we feel like would be maybe a long-term better use of funds than the bonus program. So that's all I have today.
Questions? Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Just thought, why, you know, we're having problems with medical personnel in rural areas and in other areas of economic depression. And we're working toward paying off college debts and so forth as a long-range plan, not just a one-year signing bonus, but they don't get this until they've fulfilled some time there. And if I would say that I would favor that much more than giving them an upfront bonus, maybe trying to work out a system whereby if we really do have a problem with this, pay off some of their school loan after they've been there for so long, and work it over a five-year period of time or something, and get them enough incentive to stay there long enough that they'd marry some local farmer's daughter or husband, or get a husband from the local community, go back to the good old days.
Any further comments from the committee? I think that we need further individual discussion before we move the bill. And for that reason, I'm going to close the public hearing and not open the work session today. But I believe that this is an important idea for how we might incent some teachers to go to those areas where we need good teachers. It's certainly a long-term problem that remains largely unaddressed. and I think that we need to be coming up with those kinds of ideas that will incent teachers to consider working in those districts. And whether we go forward with this depends on the will of the committee. But at this point, I'm just going to close our public hearing. Senator Gordon?
Yes, Mr. Chair, before you do that, I would like to make a couple of comments. I would like for Senator Deckard to know that I support the concept, and I think it's one that we have the opportunity to explore in the policy board process that I mentioned earlier. But then, you know, to be frank, sending the bill along to Ways and Means, if we were to do that, you know, we all know that's an exercise in futility because there's no funding there. What we do need to do, though, is continue having the public policy discussion and the place where that can happen and engage, you know, a lot of good people in the conversation is in that policy board process that's been open to us. So that's what I would encourage, as opposed to engaging in an exercise.
I would agree that the prospects of Ways and Means adopting it's an uphill battle. I would agree. Although I do think, I think Senator Fisher offers a good suggestion of the student loan question, because I think that's also a big impediment for many, many, too many students today.
Mm-hmm. Good suggestion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Question on the statewide summary. Do these figures include the step increases, and do they include all of the PERS
doesn't
donation and the health policies and
does not.
That's my guess as well. Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, if you look at one of those columns, the minimum and the maximum, I believe those do reflect the steps, the first
maximum
step,
do.
And then the maximum step, but not the. I think there's 7, 8, or 9 steps.
Yeah.
In each category.
Probably less than 7 or 9, but there's several steps. And that, they're just illustrating the bottom step and the top step in this presentation, and it's salary only, I'm sure. So, anything further? We have,
I guess just on that basis, I'd like to know, I have my staff do just a little checking on salaries and stuff, and we can't come up with anything here basically on a statewide average, at least not with the statistics we get from employment and other places. They've got so-called averages of what Oregon is with other states and all this kind of stuff, but it's not very significant to what I was asking. You know, if you just run through 4 years of college and go out and everybody, just take everybody that goes out there and goes to work, what they're actually average making, and wondering how this compared. But I would very definitely like to see the average figured in with the retirement and health benefits and stuff like that, see where we stood.
We'll see if we can find some information on that for you. We are still getting bills, and we've been notified that we will cease to hear Senate bills on April 15th. So we've got a lot of work. We'll try to schedule hearings on all of our bills, and I don't want to move a lot of legislation unless it's good legislation, and so we will work to arrive at and bipartisan support on the committee before we move things out. And we will see where we go from here. I want to set meetings with each of you in the week ahead and talk about your issues and concerns. And I think that that's important that we have that discussion, so I can have some guidance from you as we go forward, particularly my vice chair. And I have neglected to get together with Senator Castillo, but we will do that. Anything else? If not, we close the public hearing and adjourn our meeting of the Senate Education Committee. And I thank you all for your kind attention.